a familiar slide. You might guess from this slide of the forks in the road that I might be continuing on my series of sermons on coming to these forks in the roads and the kind of decisions that we should be thinking about, not just in the major life decisions, but in our everyday decisions. You know, one thing I've noticed when I've noticed that I'm actually listening to my sermons because I'm starting to notice things, you know, the day-to-day things. You come to this decision, you can say something or not say something, you can do something or not do something, and I'm starting to think about that more. And so, wow, I must be pretty effective. I'm actually listening to my own sermons. And I'll give you one example of that. It has to do with my favorite sermon topic, which is basketball. And as you know, I do play a lot of basketball. And I have a regular Tuesday, Thursday noontime game over at LSU, which is mostly faculty and some graduate students. And there's about 10 or 12 in the group that we play together. But quite often, only 5, 6, or 7 will show up. So we don't have enough for a full-court game. But there's always students hanging around, shooting and so forth, and usually we can pick up some students and have enough to play a game, so we'll recruit some students. And that happened this past Thursday. We're playing. We had about 6 or 7 of us, so we recruited some students and divided up the teams. And so we divided up the teams, and there's one fella that used to play with us a lot. I hadn't seen him in a long while, but he showed up. He's not my favorite player to play with. Some players are kind of like black holes. When you throw them the ball, you never see it again because they always shoot it, kind of thing. But anyway, he was there, and so we divided the sides. He wasn't too happy with the sides. And so I won't go by his name, but I'll go by his nickname, at least the nickname that I've given him, the whiner. And so he used to say, "Oh, these sides are terrible. This isn't fair." And, of course, nobody else in his team was complaining. And one of the guys in his team, "Oh, well, let's just go ahead and play. If they're unfair, we can redo the teams next game." Because we play games to 24 points. We usually get in at least 3 or 4 games during an hour and a half lunchtime. So we started playing. And it was a fairly even game. My team was a little better, and we tend to be up by 4 to 6 points a good part of the game. Ended up beating them by 4 points. Now, once we got up to about the last couple of baskets, the whiner started whining again because the game was close enough that he saw that there's no way to say the sides weren't fair because it was close. You know, 4 points to the final point differential, and I said, but so he started whining and said, "Y'all guys aren't trying. Y'all are coasting. You're just not trying because you don't want to break up that team, and it's not fair." It ended up with that little margin of difference. Nobody felt like the teams needed to be broke up. Matter of fact, several guys in the team said, "We want to play you again." And so we played a second game, and it went about the same way. I think we won by 6 or 8 points in that one. And the whiner was whining again all through that game. And so we began to start to play a third game, and one of my teammates on my team, the whiner was right in one respect. There was one guy on our team that was coasting, but he pretty much always coasts. Because he's by far the best player out there on the court on either team. He's about 6'5". He's deadly on the three-point outside shot. He can dribble and drive. He can rebound. He plays defense. and he recognizes that he's in a little bit different level from the rest of us amateurs. And so he plays within the team framework. He'll pass up shots that he'll probably make 90% of the time to pass the ball to somebody else that maybe is going to make them about 30% of the time. You know, he plays within the framework of the game. He doesn't try to hog the ball, dominate, but he can. And sometimes when he gets behind, particularly near the end of the game, he'll do just that. He'll start, you know, playing hard. Well, he was on our team. So one of my teammates said, "Okay, you take this guy. And we'll take that guy. And so we traded these two players. The best guy on our team, turns out it was the worst guy on the other team. And so we made the switch, played another game. And I said, oh boy, we're going to get beat in this one. And you have to remember, you know, there's life and there's basketball. And basketball is war. I mean, you're out for total victory. You know, it's just the way it is. And so we get out there and we play pretty hard in our own feeble attempts to be basketball players. But so now this changed the balance of the game completely. And so we went out there. We played pretty hard. And the score was back and forth. We stayed pretty even. We got down, I think the score was like 19-18 in our favor. And I hit a basket and made it, gave us 21. They went down. This all-star hit a three-pointer that made it 21 up. So if anybody, next person that made a three-point basket wins the game. And so we came down, and this guy, he's an okay player on our team, throws up this three-pointer from downtown. And he's not that good a three-point shooter anyway. He backs it in. So we win the game. So we're all happy we won the game, even though the odds were changed a lot. And we were all walking off. And, you know, we're friends and so forth. And we laugh and we kid and so forth. And so as we're walking off, I did it. I had this fork in the road. I could say something or keep my mouth shut. And it just came out, that intuitive mind of mine. And I said to the group, the whiner was right there. You know, nobody was really that concerned about the game except the whiner. He wasn't happy at all. And I said, okay, you guys, which player on our team do you want us to give you this time to even up the size? So everybody laughed. One of the fellows said, oh, boy, that's really rubbing salt in the wound. And, you know, just laughed it off. Whiner wasn't laughing. And so here was a point where I probably should have kept my big mouth shut just because of the whiner. But it just kind of popped out, and I realized, boy, here I'm preaching these kind of things, and look what I'm doing. You know, my only justification is, like I said, basketball is war. But anyway, you know, these kind of things happen day in, day out. We constantly see these kind of things where we say or not say something, do or not do something, that they build up. They build up and they become habits. And they become who we are if we're not careful. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm going in giving this this series of sermons. You know, so when we make these fork in the road types of decisions daily. And I've talked about six in past sermons. I've talked about six different types of choices that we often run into, sometimes major, sometimes minor, or most of the time minor. The first one I talked about was the attitude to either deal with it versus expediency. You know, you can either deal with it the right way or you just kind of get it done. Kind of thing. We talked about that some. Then another one was responsibility versus blame. When something happens, do you take responsibility for your actions or do you blame somebody else? That's very easy. Blame your spouse. It's always the spouse's fault anyway, right? Now, but we can fall into that fork in the road where we start blaming instead of taking responsibility for our actions. Respectfulness versus opinionated. Unfortunately, some of us think our opinions are facts, and we don't respect other people's opinions. And so, you know, there's a choice. There's a kind of choice we have to make, or we're going to be respectful or opinionated. I talked about being inspiring versus motivating. You know, that some of these things, they're not necessarily sins. But one is better than the other. You know, you can do the better versus a worse, a good versus a better, a best versus good. You know, some of these things are like that, but they define your character. You know, it could be a poor choice versus a good choice. And the same, you know, motivate is a way to get things done, and sometimes it's good, it works. But a better way would be to inspire others to get things done. And so we talked about that some. And then talking about being principled versus pragmatic. Again, pragmatic is not necessarily bad, it's not necessarily a sin, but making sure you're focusing on the principles in decisions you make more than anything else. And then I've talked about being insightful versus obstinate. Now, I'm sure there's no obstinate people in this congregation, but just in case that you might fall in that trap occasionally, I decided I better throw that one in. So that's the things that we've talked about, and I want to talk about a couple more today, and really ask this question that I asked last time: do you really understand the types of choices you make every day? These forks in the road that you come to, and the choices you make. These choices determine how you grow, if you will grow. Now let's start today with two of more choices, and this kind of goes to my introduction: being reflective or fire from the hip. I kind of fire from the hip there with that basketball comment I made. Again, I knew that the whiner would take it the wrong way. And who knows? Suppose the whiner shows up for church sometime. He might remember that. But this is something that happens quite often. Do we really reflect on what we're getting ready to say or do, or just kind of fire from the hip? In 1 Timothy 4, verse 15... notice what Paul writes here in 1 Timothy 4:15. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all. He's saying, think. Commit yourself to thinking before you act, is basically what he's saying here. And if you do that, your growth will be evident to all. Now, leading up to verse 15, let's go back a couple of verses to verse 12, 1 Timothy 4:12. Let no one despise your youth. This is kind of leading into why he said what he said in verse 15. Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. And that's the first of these six things that he listed here, is in word. Not just in the Word of God, but in the words you speak. Be reflective. Don't fire from the hip. Let's look at Psalm 49 and verse 3. Psalm 49 and verse 3 on this idea of being reflective. My mouth shall speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall give understanding. You start being reflective, you start having more wisdom, you start having more understanding. You develop a good habit as opposed to a bad habit. As they say, engage your brain before you put your mouth in gear. That's what we're talking about here. Psalm 49 and verse 3, my mouth shall speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall give understanding. Again, being reflective. Ephesians 4 and verse 29. Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Again, all these things are emphasizing being reflective. Now let's look on the other side, the fire from the hip kind of approach. Psalm 39 verse 1. I said I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle, while the wicked are before me. And sometimes you're in a situation where, you want to kind of lash out, say some things, fire from the hip. You've got to learn to realize you're the fork in the road when that happens. That intuitive mind is sometimes hard to control. It just acts on its own, it seems like. You've got to train it. Analytical mind has got to make sure it stays in charge. Look at Proverbs 17 and verse 20. He who has a deceitful heart finds no good, and he who has a perverse tongue falls into evil. So again, you see the same thing. This is something that happens day in and day out to us if we're not on our toes. If we're not being reflective. If we're just being intuitive and letting things just flow. Now, let's move on to a second thing. And by way of introduction here, I want to first talk about, before I tell you what this next one is, talk about what every baptized member was counseled to do, which is to count the cost. Why were all you baptized members told to count the cost? I mean, is it really that big a cost? I mean, don't you get God's blessings? Aren't you happy? You know, when you get baptized, doesn't everything start working out? Isn't everything perfect? Now, I kind of went into baptism and didn't pay too much attention to this counseling that said, count the cost. Yeah, I can't work on the Sabbath. It might cost me a few bucks here and there. But yeah, I didn't think much about anything else. I was interested in the blessings. And I was interested in the place of safety. And I was interested in all the good things that were going to happen. And I wasn't thinking too much about counting the cost. But let's look at that passage in Luke 14, in verse 26, beginning in verse 26. And you go back to verse 23, you'll see that Christ was speaking to a great multitude. He wasn't just talking to his disciples. He was preaching to a large group of people at the time. But Luke 14 is beginning in verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Now, that's pretty strong words. And let's continue on here. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me, he cannot be my disciple. For for which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build what he was not able. Now, we read this scripture, and the translations kind of varies, and it's pointed out quite often that you say anyone does not hate his father and family and so forth, that the Greek word has an implication of to love less by comparison. But it also means to detest. You start looking at how that Greek word is used. It's a fairly strong word. It's not hate in the sense that we may think about in terms of Christ saying, don't hate, that sort of thing. But it's a pretty strong word in that you value it so little that you'd really give it up, even your own life, that sort of thing. That's a pretty big commitment, is the message here. Let's continue on. In verse 31, what king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. That's pretty strong word. It's saying, man, you're going to have to give up a lot. And like I said, I know when I was canceled baptism, I didn't pay much attention to that because I was thinking of all the blessings. And there are a lot of blessings. But there is a huge cost at the same time. And you have to be aware of that, and you have to be making that commitment. Which brings me to what I want to talk about here as this next fork in the road is accepting the challenge versus the path of least resistance. Accepting the challenge versus the path of least resistance. You know, one good example of how we can either accept the challenge or take the path of least resistance, well, it goes back to my childhood and probably many of you here in your childhood. When you've reached that point of the first time you ever went off the high diving board. Remember that? Remember the occasion that you first climbed up that 1,000-foot high diving board to jump off that very first time? Was it easy? Did you just, oh boy, there's a high board. I'm going to climb up that thing and jump off, and didn't think much about it. Now, it was a challenge. At least it was for me the first time. It was a challenge. You know, you thought about it. You know, that thing looks fine. It's about, you know, about 10 feet. It's not much higher than a ceiling. Or, you know, some houses have 10-foot ceilings. Not that high, typically, high diving board. But, man, it looks so high. And you think about it, and you know, maybe some of your friends have gone off of it, some haven't. And so there's a challenge there. Do you accept that challenge? And so, you know, most of the time, especially if you're a guy, you end up accepting that challenge. You climb up that ladder, stand up there, and if it looked high from the ground, you get up there, and now it's like a million miles high when you're looking down. You know, so you're standing there. Now you're in a quandary because you're up there. You either walk out to the end and jump off, or you can climb back down the ladder and be humiliated for life. In addition to that, every single person, thousands in that pool, are watching to see if you're going to actually jump off and kill yourself. And so you're standing there. You know, and some people will back down and climb back down the ladder, risk the humiliation, not accept the challenge. But then some will get out there and they'll tiptoe out to the end. You know, it probably wouldn't be so bad if you just went out there and jumped. I don't know about you, but I tiptoed out there and just looked and thought about it long and hard and wondered if I was going to survive the next few seconds. But somewhere along the way, sometimes you turn around and walk back off that board, but you jump. You finally accept that challenge. You jump. It seems like forever going down. You hit that water. Then you keep going. Now, not like jumping off the low board or the side of the pool. You just keep going down, down, down. And you wonder if you're ever going to stop and come back up. But you do. And you come back up and you say, hey, that wasn't so bad. You swim to the side, go back up there and do it again. You know, you accepted the challenge and you moved on. Rather than taking the path of least resistance of never climbing up that ladder, or once you get up there, like, I don't want to do this, and climb back down. That's what I'm talking about here. Accepting the challenge. And there are a tremendous number of challenges out there. You know, let's look at some of these challenges. For example, kind of what we just talked about in looking at the what we all go through in baptism counseling, that we are, it may alienate our families. Look at Matthew 10 and verse 35. Matthew 10 and verse 35. But do not think I've come to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set man against his father, a daughter against his mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now, that's a pretty strong challenge, isn't it? See, these are the kinds of things you're going to face. You know, your family is likely to be disrupted because of the path that you are choosing. So you're really going to choose that path and be challenged by God, or you're just going to take the path of least resistance and go down to the Baptist church down the street. And it's something that it just doesn't happen. You know, okay, all right, I got the challenge. Everybody's mad at me. That's the end of it. No, it's an ongoing thing. I've mentioned that I'm on a committee that writes for the Life, Hope, and Truth website. and we review articles in one topic area. It's called the God silo. And a minister wrote an article for review, and it may end up being published in Discern rather than Life, Hope, and Truth, but it'll come out in either one or perhaps even both of them. And I'm not going to go into a lot of details about it. But he came into the church with his mother when he was a youngster. And the whole article is talking about how his father reacted to it. And his father hated the church, was abusive to both this minister's mother and to him. And he cites various examples, which I won't all go into, but in one case, he followed them to church one day where the meeting started banging on the door. A deacon came out to see what was going on and punched the deacon in the face. That's how he felt. And this went on for years and years and years. And so it was an inspiring article because as he related, after many years, he actually came to terms, you might say, with his father, made peace, and his father finally came to respect him as a minister and what he had done and the decisions he made. But he went through years of hell before that happened. And the point of the article is that, you know, things, God does work things out, but there are a lot of challenges along the way. Very inspiring article. I'm not going to provide any more details, but when it comes out, be sure and read that article. But you know, we have these kind of challenges, and they're daily challenges that we have to deal with, and we have to keep making the right decisions and how to deal with those, because we're challenged every day. Look over at 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 7. This is another challenge. Healing. It's a challenge to us. We're not always healed. Paul had a problem. He said, "Lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan, to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might be departed from me. And he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me.'" Anyway, here was Paul. He's going around, he's healing people. You know, snakes, bites, nothing. You know, casting out demons, whatever. But yet he goes to God and says, God said, "No, not healing you. Live with it." Now, that's a real challenge. That can turn you away from the faith. But you got to accept whatever challenge God lays before you. Let him work it out. He will either heal you or he won't. But he, as Christ promised, will never leave you. He will be there. He will work it out. Huge challenge there. Let's look at Matthew 5:44. Here's another challenge. Love your enemies. That's the challenge. "But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." Now think about it for a minute. During the last week, during this past week, think about all your prayers during this past week. How much time have you spent praying for your enemies? Praying for those who might be causing you problems? I don't know. I can't look inside your mind, but I dare say you probably haven't spent enough time to fulfill this wish. This is a challenge. Just like on the basketball court. I don't want to love them. I want to crush them. And we can feel exactly the same way in our lives with people. A huge challenge. In Matthew 5:48. Here's a challenge. Therefore, you should be perfect. Just be perfect. That's all God wants. Just be perfect. As your Father in heaven is perfect. Got an extra eye in there, it looks like. Be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. But that's a challenge. God doesn't say be good. He doesn't say be pretty good. He doesn't say be very good. He says, don't sin at all. Be perfect. Talk about a challenge. Then he says things like Luke 12 and verse 22. Don't worry. Don't worry. Anybody has gone through this entire week and did not worry about anything? I didn't see anybody raising their hand. It's hard not to worry about things, isn't it? But that's what Christ said here. Then he said to his disciples, therefore I say to you, don't worry about your life, what you'll eat, nor about the body, what you'll put on. Now, these day-to-day things, just living, don't worry so much. God will take care of it. That's a challenge. It's hard to take that path. I'm just not going to worry about this. I'll do everything I can. God will have to do the rest. But I'm not going to worry about it. That is the challenge. Look at Romans 12 and verse 2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Is this fair? I just ask. Is this fair? He sticks us in this world. And then says, don't be conformed to it. He doesn't want to be conformed to us. Take us out somewhere away from us so we don't have to deal with it all. We can fall into that kind of mindset, can't we? That we're here in this world, but don't be conformed to it. Day to day, we have to make decisions. Conform to this world, not conform to this world. Which path am I going to take? On all the little things. Not just the major decisions, but all of the little things. Then look at Philippians 2:3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Esteem others better than yourself. That's a challenge. Now, I've just hit a few of the highlights of the kind of challenges that God lays before us. There's a ton of other ones that we can go through. But what God is saying is, here's a path here. Accept the challenge, or just kind of go through a path of least resistance and not accept the challenge. You're going to jump off that diving board, or you're going to climb back down the ladder kind of approach. That's what God lays before us. Two paths. Accept the challenge or just kind of ease back. Try to get by. Do the best you can. Let's look at, let's go a little bit further here. 2 Samuel 12, and verse 13. This is a tough one. Dealing with the death of the innocent. Example of David after his sin with Bathsheba. So David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also who is born to you shall surely die. That's tough. What did the child do? How does the child have any blame for any of this? He had to die. That was punishment to David and Bathsheba. But it also punished the child. Now, it's a challenge to deal with these sort of things. You know, it's things like this that will have had, and I've heard people say this, I can't worship a God who lets innocent children die. I can't worship that kind of God. And I would have a lot of trouble with worshiping that kind of God too if I didn't understand God's plan. If I didn't understand that child will be resurrected in a much better environment to grow and learn about God and have his chance at salvation. Without understanding that plan of God, I don't know how people do worship God without that understanding. That death comes to us all, some early, some late, but the point is, there is a resurrection. So all will have a chance to get to know God, to come to God, and eventually be spiritually resurrected. These are challenges. Now, the path of least resistance. Let's look at that side of it. And the question that I want you to think about here is, what is the fallback position for seeking the path of least resistance as a Christian? What is the fallback position? What is the path of least resistance? We're Christians. We've got to deal with these things. But what would be the fallback position if we don't want to accept the challenges? We kind of fall, but we still want to worship God. What's the fallback position that people tend to take? Well, I want to look at the example of Job here. Job 2 and verse 10. I'm going to turn to several scriptures here in Job, but you know the story. Job lost everything. Family, wealth, had boils all over him. I mean, the only thing he didn't lose was his wife. And she started rubbing salt in the wound by nagging him. And that's what we see in verse 10 here of Job 2. But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women. You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. It doesn't say Job was not sinning. But he did not sin with his lips. Now think about, you know, what happens through the book of Job. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the book of Job, but I'm going to turn just a couple of verses here to get the flavor. You know, what was Job's thinking? What was his mindset? Look at chapter 6 and verse 29. Job is speaking. He says, "Yield now, let there be no injustice. Yes, concede, my righteousness still stands." I haven't sinned. But I'm not cursing God. Because cursing God is breaking one of the Ten Commandments. And I stand by the law. Basically what he's saying, isn't it? Matter of fact, is he not saying, basically, I stand by the letter of the law. I haven't sinned. Now, you start looking through this and you see the case he's making. And the case appears to be one primarily of, I obey the letter of the law. Job 13, verse 18. "See now, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. I am innocent." I look at Job 23 and verse 11. "My foot has held fast to his steps. I have kept his way. not turned aside, I have not departed from the commandment of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. So he's saying, look, I'm keeping the law. I'm keeping the commandments. I haven't strayed from the commandments. You know, that's the case that he's made all the way through. All those some 30 chapters or so that he makes his case and debates with his friends. That's the case he's making. His emphasis is on the law. Keeping the letter of the law. And then finally, in Job 42, beginning in verse 3, he says, "You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." Now think about this for a minute, what he's saying here. He's saying, I've heard you with my ears, but now my eyes have seen you. And we won't turn there, but Christ quoted Isaiah several times in the New Testament about people who have ears but don't hear and eyes that don't see. Talking about the people of his time when Christ was preaching. And so it sounds like there's kind of three categories here. You know, there's people who neither see nor hear. There's people who hear but don't see. And then there's people who hear and see. What's the difference between hearing and seeing? Well, Job kind of explains it in context here. He says, I heard, but I didn't see. I knew the law. I knew the words. I knew what they meant. Don't steal, don't kill, don't lie, don't cheat, don't commit adultery. Haven't done any of those things. He heard, but he didn't see. Yeah, and that's what Christ was saying when he quoted Isaiah. He said, yeah, there are people who neither hear nor see. But you who are called have the opportunity to not only hear, but to see. In other words, understand the letter of the law, but also the values that are behind it. To see the wisdom of the law, to see the depth of the law. And that's what Job finally got. He realized he was self-righteous. But he saw that all the law had depths that he had never really thought about. Galatians 3 and verse 22. But the Scripture has confined all under sin, that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterwards be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor. In past sermons, I've used the term there. The law was a proxy. The law was a proxy for the values behind those laws. The law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we no longer are under the tutor. We no longer need the proxy because we understand the depth of the law. The law is a proxy for values. But the fallback position for, quote, Christians is the letter of the law, not the values of the law. See, that's the path of least resistance. Okay, I'll keep the Sabbath. I do all these things. You know, isn't that exactly what the Pharisees did? You know, that was their fallback position. And what did Christ say to them in Matthew 23, verse 23? Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay the tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weighty matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. You know, talked about faith again. We were just talking about that. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. See, don't fall into the trap of, I've done so good here. I've done so good that I'm keeping the law. I'm not killing, I'm not cheating, I'm not stealing, I'm not doing any of these things. I go to services every Sabbath. That's the path of least resistance, if that's all you're doing, instead of accepting the challenge. Look at Luke 13 and verse 24, or beginning in verse 24. Strive to enter through the narrow gate. We talked about this before. For many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able. But once the master of the house has risen up and shut the door, you begin to stand outside and knock at the door, saying, Lord, Lord, open for us. And he will answer and say to you, I do not know you. Where you are from? You imagine coming before God, saying, man, this is it. He says, who are you? I don't know you. Where did you come from? Then you will begin to say, we ate and drank in your presence. When is the last time you ate and drank in God's presence? Well, I'd say probably the most recent Passover, if you were baptized. You ate and drank in God's presence. The last time we had a potluck here on the Sabbath, you were eating and drinking in God's presence. Yeah, we did those things. He taught us in the streets, in our streets. Well, this isn't exactly in the street, but it's right next to the street. And yeah, we were there every Sabbath. You taught us. We heard the words. But did you understand the values? But he will say, I tell you, I do not know you, where you are from. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity. That's scary. That's very scary when you think about it. That you can be taking the path of least resistance instead of accepting the challenges, not even be realizing it. Not even be truly thinking about it. All right, let's take one more, which would be a short one here. And that is passionate versus complacent. Passionate versus complacent. I want to look over at Isaiah 32 and verse 9 in Scripture here. Now, the context here in Isaiah centers around a couple of things. You go back to chapter 31, and it speaks, this was at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, the exile and so forth. He speaks of going down to Egypt after the destruction of Jerusalem then. At the beginning of chapter 32, it talks about the return of Christ. And so the chronology is not exactly, you can't say for sure exactly what the chronology is. But it kind of sounds like, at least that from the perspective of that time, it's talking about when they made the decision to go down to Egypt, when God told them not to. But in Isaiah 32, verse 9, rise up, you women who are at ease. Hear my voice, you complacent daughters. Give ear to my speech. In a year and some days you will be troubled, you complacent women, for the vintage will fail, the gatherings will not come. Tremble, you women who are at ease. Be troubled, you complacent ones. Strip yourselves, make yourselves bare, and gird sackcloth on your waist. In other words, go into sackcloth and ashes type of fasting. And so he's talking about getting very complacent, very comfortable with where you are. Kind of losing that passion. Just being, here's another Sabbath, time to go to church, go through the routine, get dressed, drive to church, hear another sermon, go home, kick back, rest. Very complacent. Easy trap to fall into. So perhaps one of the greatest examples in all the Bible of complacency It's covered by Dr. Levy and this Bible study in the book of Esther. We just look at that one verse, Esther 6, verse 6. When Haman, king, realized that Mordecai had not been rewarded for some service he had done, and Haman happened to be the person standing outside there, and so in verse 6, 6 there, that's Esther. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights in to honor?" And now Haman thought in his heart, "Who would the king delight to honor more than me?" Now that's complacent. I'm the man. There's a lot of things going on here. But he was very, very complacent about his position, as well as very prideful, of course. But we can fall into that kind of trap. You know, we can choose complacency over being passionate about God, about the work. The opposite extreme. Was anybody more passionate than David? You know, just looking through just a few things. Things you don't think about much. He was a royal harpist. He just kind of sit down and say, "I think I'll learn to play the harp today." You know, he was the royal harpist. You know, he was a very accomplished musician. That's not just complacent. That's passion. He killed Goliath. That certainly wasn't complacent. He had some passion to take that on. The psalmist. And you read David's psalms that he wrote. It just oozes with his passionate feelings about God and his way and the truth. All those things. As a warrior, greatest warrior of his era, by the time he was through with his wars and his conquering, his son Solomon had a peaceful reign, almost his entire reign, because all the enemies were destroyed. He was faithful. Of course he sinned, but he was faithful. That was the last major project that David took on in his old age. Build the temple. Or at least prepare to build the temple. He made all the plans. He did the designing. He laid it all out. He gathered all the materials. He said, "God won't let me do it." He told his son to do it. Now, there is passion. And so, what does David get for all that? Ezekiel 34, verses 23 and 24. "I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them. My servant David. He shall feed them, be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God. And my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken." So we kind of know about where David is going to be in the kingdom. Now we understand that the Lord that's speaking here was the Son of God, Jesus Christ, before his human birth. You know, so we know it's God, we know it's Christ. It appears to be David over his people. That's where passion gets you. Where does complacency get you? Not much of anywhere. Death, that's all it does for you. You know, this is the ninth of these different paths we could take that I've talked about, and I've scratched the surface. You know, I could give sermons for the rest of the year on these different kinds of choices we make. I'm not going to do that. But I could. But you probably should. In your own lives, you should be looking at the kind of choices that you are making in your daily lives. What are you doing? What kind of choice are you really analyzing these forks in the road that you come to so many times in a day? Little things, big things, everything. Are you really analyzing them and looking at the choices that you're making, the forks in the road that you're choosing? You really analyze. That's called growth. When you begin to see what you're doing and change, that's called growth. You know, we've talked about three here, reflective versus fire from the hip. We talked about accepting the challenge versus the path of least resistance. And we talked about passion versus complacency. What kind of forks in the road are you taking? Do you even recognize a fork in the road when you come to it? Do you even recognize it? Are you choosing the right path? You need to be asking yourself that daily.